Hello and welcome to the IWF's podcast series In Conversation With, where today we're going to be talking about self-generated child sexual abuse imagery and what we mean by this. What is it that we see at IWF? And the reason we're talking about this is because today we've published some figures on our website which say that we've seen 20,000 cases of self-generated child sexual abuse material in the first half of this year that specifically show children aged 7 to 10 years old. This is the fastest growing age group that we see. It's not the biggest age group, but it is the fastest growing age group. And I think it deserves us pausing and thinking about what does this mean is happening to children in our homes, whether it's in the UK or overseas. So with me today is our resident expert, Rosa, who's an IWF analyst, a senior analyst, and there isn't much she doesn't know about this material. So welcome, Rosa.
Oh, thanks, Emma.
Let's start with one thing. Rose is not your real name, is it? Let's explain this first of all. Why are we using a different name? Why do you and your colleagues use different names?
Yeah, that's right. It's not my real name. We use a different name when we're speaking publicly about our work, because it's important for us to really keep a distance between what we're seeing, which is awful, you know, in our home lives where we go home to our children and our families, and we want to really create that distance. And also, we don't want to be recognised. We don't want people to have too much of an interest or being really sort of nosy into what we do, because it is very, very serious and it can be very distressing as well. So we just want to really draw that line between who we are at home and who we are at work.
Sounds very sensible. Before we get going into what is a distressing topic, I want to pause here, and for anybody listening, just to say that we're not going to be using gratuitous language. We're going to be using proper words for things, but actually we're talking about something very, very serious and harmful happening to children. And here is the health warning. This is an adult conversation for adults to hear, not for children to hear. That should hopefully go without saying. But also, this could be very triggering if there's been anything like this in your life as well. So please do consider whether this is the right kind of podcast for you to be, or right kind of episode for you to be listening to. So I just want to make that clear really high up before we get into this. So on that note, we will get into this. When we say self-generated child sexual abuse material, what do we mean? And also, there's a part B to this. Why do we not like the term self-generated? Let's discuss that first of all.
Sure. So what do we mean? It's actually not particularly clear from the name, is it? And I think what might be a good idea is for me to just imagine, get you to imagine a child using some kind of device with a webcam in a private place. And then I want you to imagine an offender, we could call them a paedophile, an abuser, an offender, in another room, in another house, another part of the country or another part of the world, who has established a remote online connection through the device with this child. The child could be in London, the offender could be the other side of the world, but they're connected through this platform, through this app, and they can see each other and exchange visuals, exchange chats, exchange little emojis and icons and things. So that's the situation that's happening. But what we see and what makes this content illegal is the fact that the child is coerced through different means to perform sexually for the offender. So we see anything from a child taking their clothes off and posing, perhaps spreading their genitals to camera, up until the most severe category that people will have heard of, which is category A content, which is a penetrative act. And perhaps we can maybe go into it a bit later what that means, but it's serious sexual activity being encouraged by a remote abuser. And the sad thing is, I think, for all of us that see this, is that this is happening in usually the child's bedroom, their private place. It's their safe place. It should be their safe place for most children. And it becomes the scene of this, well, criminal content, I suppose.
And then when we talk about this, we've kind of grown over the years. Okay, so let's go back 10 years. We didn't see this 10 years ago. We know that. We didn't see this in this way 10 years ago. And we've been trying to grapple as a sector, as many individuals have, with what to call this particular type of sexual abuse where the offender is not physically present. And the best word that we've come up with so far is self-generated. But what's wrong with that word?
I think it's the word self, isn't it? It implies that the victim who, you know, we've just said it could be a seven-year-old girl or boy, that somehow they're responsible for what's happened, which is absolutely not the case. They are very much the victim. It just so happens that because they are on their own, they are holding a recording device that, they have, you could say, a role in the recording of what's happening, the filming of what's happening. But of course, that behaviour is being coerced by the abuser, by the offender. So we really need to take the self part out of that term, I think, and really allow people to see that the abuser on the other end is the person responsible for generating and causing this content and asking this child to perform sexually for them.
And of course, I guess in your role in the hotline, and one reason perhaps why the numbers and the figures are so big is that this content, once it's been created, it just then goes. It's just distributed, isn't it? We'll come back to that point, but can you start with what a typical day is for you and your colleagues in the hotline, just to give people a sense of what the space and what does it look like? Are you underground? Are you in the dark? Then what do you do when you come into the office?
Well, it's a very normal looking office, which I don't know why, but some people are surprised to hear that. But we, you know, we're all sitting at desks. We have three screens, you know, so it's a very visual, eyes on, kind of a quiet, careful job because we're really paying close attention to what we're seeing all the time. But essentially, we're looking at URLs, so website addresses that the public have sent to us because they're worried that they think there might be a child present or child sexual abuse material present. So we make assessments. So we're loading websites. We're looking carefully at who we can see on the screen. We're making age assessments. We're saying, is this criminal? We might call each other over and say, how old do you think this person might be? Do we think this is a child? Do we recognize this person? So that's kind of a normal day where we're looking at websites, and we're also proactively finding child sexual abuse material online, because sadly we know where to look, and sadly it doesn't take us very long to find it. So we use a big portion of our sort of workforce and time to go looking for images of children that we can remove. Yeah.
Certainly that's been the most effective way we've found over the past few years to find the vast numbers that we have. So take us back then to this scenario where a child might be in their bedroom, well, likely to be in their bedroom, you're saying. They've been encouraged into some kind of sexual activity. What happens to it? Who is the one capturing it, do you think? And then what happens to it once that's happened?
So, I mean, if you can imagine from the child's perspective, they're having this, you know, we all know what live streaming is now. From the child's perspective, they're thinking, this is happening in the moment. There's someone on the other end, there's me, this is happening. And, you know, as soon as it's finished, they might forget about it. They might think that was a one-off. No one else will see that, only the person on the other end. So maybe it's okay, fingers crossed. But I don't think children are aware that the person, the abuser on the end, is recording the live stream. And their intention when they record the live stream is to distribute it, to share it to other online offenders, almost like a trophy. Look what I managed to get him or her to do for me. And so the video could easily be circulated. And not only that, it could also be cut into images, you know, still images, where it shows something very explicit or a progression of a child undressing to performing a sexual act as sort of clickbait for other offenders online or collections to share. And the really awful thing is, Emma, I don't think children, and why would they? But I don't think the children are aware that that's happening. You know, I don't think they're sophisticated enough to know that someone is that manipulative to exploit them in that way.
It's incredibly sad. Can you tell us a little bit about category A, B and C, which is something that we're incredibly familiar with, but it might be new. Why do we have categories and how does that apply to self-generated child sexual abuse material?
Yeah, that's right. So we have category A, category B, category C. And as you probably hear in the news when you read articles, category A is the most severe category of child sexual abuse images. So category A will involve typically, and I'm generalizing here, penetration, bestiality, sadism or degradation. And just even saying those words in association with a child just seems so incredibly wrong. And when it comes to applying those categories to self-generated content, you might be thinking, how can we have a penetrative act when the child is alone in their bedroom? So the abuser isn't in the bedroom, let's remember that. So, you know, you might be thinking, how do we get category A? And this is, again, incredibly sad to kind of go into, but children, it's not uncommon at all for children to be asked to find an object that might be in their bedroom that they can insert into themselves on request of the abuser. And we're just talking normal bedroom objects, you know, that the abuser might spot in the video connection and then use to their advantage. And this is boys and girls, not just girls. Category B, where sexual activity or masturbation. So it's not, again, uncommon for children to be asked to masturbate to camera, touch themselves. And particularly when we're talking about 7 to 10-year-olds, often they're asked to touch themselves or other more slang language around the term masturbate, and you can tell that they don't know what that means. So they're sort of guessing or looking confused, and it's incredibly sad to see a confused child being asked to touch themselves and not really knowing what to do but doing it anyway. And that really hits home. And we have category C content, which generally we could say is children posing in a sexualized way, usually naked to camera. It could be an exposing of the genitals or being instructed to pose in a certain way to really expose themselves. So it's really very explicit images. So if we think about a category C example, we might imagine a boy who's naked in his bedroom, and he might have an erect penis, and he's been told to stand in front of the camera and move around, perhaps bend over, you know, just so the offender can get the shots and the material that they want. It's quite shocking to hear it, isn't it? Because you can't imagine that the lovely bedroom where the child goes to sleep and, you know, feels all cozy can be abused in that way. It just seems really, really wrong. Really unlikely, but it's very common.
It's really shocking to hear you go from reading the very clinical legal language around category A, B and C to how it is in reality applied to the images, what it is in reality, what that actually means that child is being asked to do. So we know they're most often in their bedrooms. And of course, you were saying the offender can see what's in the surroundings and then encourage them to find objects which they could use. How is the offender communicating, do you think? Is it talking? Is it typing? Is it showing them other things on the screen? How do you think that happens? Because obviously you only see it from the perspective, I guess, of the offender, don't you? You can just see the child.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it really depends what platform the child is using. So some platforms will allow you to sort of have text chat. You know, the offender might type something or type a request, or perhaps they might be speaking to each other, or both. And sometimes the content we see, the language isn't a language that we know, and so we don't know what's being asked. But often there's a lot of exchanges of what I would call like electronic tokens, you know, whether it's like a little heart or some other symbol that indicates the abuser is enjoying what's happening to encourage the performance further. So there's that kind of language of exchanging tokens, if you like. So it's a mixture of all. It really depends on what's being used, what platform, I think.
And I think the shocking thing that people might reflect on is they might say, Well, where are the parents? Where is the person in charge? Where are the carers? Do you have any indication of that from what you see?
Yeah. Do you know what we do? Because when we are able to listen to audio on some of these videos, you can hear household noise, you know, and that might be banging from the kitchen, you know, getting a meal ready. It might be someone running up and down the stairs, or just people shouting at each other in the house. Normal stuff that you'd hear in any house, you know. And I've heard children who are on this live stream with an offender, they'll be shouting, "Don't come into my room, I'm getting dressed." But in fact, what they're actually doing is they're following the instructions and the orders of the offender, and they're very aware that nobody can come in. You know, I've seen other siblings or children in the house wandering in a nappy, dog wandering in, pets, you know. And sometimes you just look at the background in the video and it's just a normal child's bedroom. There's mess on the floor, there's posters, football shirts, cupboards spilling open with clothes. And you just think, this is a normal day in a normal child's bedroom. It's just so normal looking. And you juxtapose that with the severity of what's going on. It's just the most bizarre and sort of upsetting combination of events.
Given that the abuser is not physically present, I do have this feeling that this should be entirely preventable if we can get it right. And, you know, a mixture of the right technology, the parents just knowing what the risks are and having an appreciation of that, perhaps education of the parents of children, carers and others in a position of responsibility. There are going to be people who are listening to this who are going to think, oh, my God, and they're going to be really shocked. What would you say to parents after hearing the reality of what it is that you see in these videos?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of messages that we can pull from this. One is, it's so important to just talk, even if that means you have to talk about sex, because I think we have to all wake up and realise that sex in this generation, in this online world where we've just come out of a lockdown, where we're all shut away and on our devices, sex exists online. And in some cases it's legal when you think about adult pornography, but then we have this big section of illegal activity that's happening. But we need to talk about it. It can't become something that's just, you know, disregarded, or we're too shy to talk about, or too embarrassed to talk about. Talk. If in doubt, talk. Ask your children. And I think perhaps, you know, if there's parents listening to this, and I'm a parent myself, talk to another parent saying, you know, did you hear this? And, you know, are you worried about it? Or like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. Like, be disgusted, because we should be, you know, and talk to someone else about it and just say, are you aware what your children are, what apps your children are using, what devices they're using? You know, do they have a lock on their bedroom? Are they shutting themselves in the bathroom for an hour? Let's just talk, because give children the chance to say if they're worried about something, or they feel bad about something, or they feel they've made a mistake, you know? Because children are being manipulated here, and we need to give them every opportunity to know that they're firstly not to blame, and that we can maybe help them if they need help.
Very well said. Thank you. And then finally, if we can end on a note that maybe to bring us out of this awful subject, how do you and your colleagues, how can you do this work? How do you stay sane? How do you continue with your normal life? You just said you're a parent. Mm-hmm. What is it that you do to detach yourself? You must have to from what you do during the day.
Yeah, we do. You have to. And, you know, I think with all of us, when we come to work, we put our IWF heads on, and we're just like, right, we need to do this. We know the scale of the problem here. And it's almost a little bit of an invisible problem, because unless you're an offender and you're illegally searching for this material, you probably don't have any idea of the scale of the problem. But we do, because we can see this material. We see it every day, probably every couple of minutes in our role in the hotline. And so being able to do something about something that's such a big problem, and I can't express the size of the problem enough, it's a good feeling to know that you're doing something. You're supporting the children, being able to take some of these images off the internet, say, this is not okay. It's hidden, but that doesn't mean it's okay, you know. So it's really good to be able to walk away and say, yes, this is awful, but I can do something is good. And then we just, I think most of us would say, we just switch off when we leave the building. We go to our lives, we drive home, we play with our children, we enjoy our home life, and we just switch off and become mummy or daddy or, you know, or whoever, and we leave it behind. You enter, I think as well, when you come into to work as an analyst, you have to adopt a certain mentality to just, like firefighters and paramedics and police workers do as well, you go in and you treat the situation logically. You can't necessarily engage emotionally with everything that you see, because otherwise you'd probably be crying most of the time. You have to really think, okay, I'm looking for what category this image is. I'm looking for, do I recognize the child? I'm looking for, can I help the child? Can I identify the child? You're thinking logically all the time. How do I help? How do I fix? What can I do within the parameters of my job? And that's how you're thinking. That's how you have to think. You can't think, this poor child, I wish I could jump in and save them, because you can't. You just have to do what you can.
That sounds like an excellent mentality, and I'm sure we will do another podcast all about welfare and looking after yourself in this kind of role, because that's a massive discussion in and of itself. Rosa, thank you so much for joining me today and talking about this really dreadful issue, but bringing it to life to people and making it real. And if this podcast has been useful to you, please leave us a review. And if you have a topic that you'd like us to dive into a little bit more, you can email us at media@iwf.org.uk. Rosa, thank you very much.
You're welcome.